Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to Game Buoy, where we talk about gaming news you haven't heard, but probably should.
And if you've already heard everything on tonight's podcast, then you're either really well informed or
in this room with us.
That's kind of creepy.
Be spooky.
That would be some, like, ghost house shit, Super Mario World style.
Seriously, or, I don't know, like, Fatal Frame?
Or Luigi's Mansion.
Yes. Luigi's Mansion.
Or any of the, like, Booze Boardwalk racing tracks. Notice how mine are all from the Mario franchise, because that, like, I don't know shit about ghosts otherwise.
Yeah, well, you know, we can't all be perfect. So, this week, we are going to go over a couple of cool news bits, and then we're going to delve into the Kickstarter discussion.
Yes, we're going to kickstart that discussion.
Okay, A for effort.
Fuck you.
real quick, I want to talk with you just for a minute, though, on a follow-up to last week's discussion topic.
Yes, because almost as if by magic, not too long after we had our grand discussion.
As if by space magic! Mass Effect 3 Extended Cut has been announced.
It has.
This is going to be, DLC content, which, you know, supposedly is going to launch at a price point of nothing. It'll be free.
Which you had predicted, so spot on. I mean, but even though we kind of knew, you know, got that one.
It
just
made business sense. It really did. And I stated all the reasons why on our last episode why I thought that would happen. It has been announced. It is going to be new game content, not just cinematics. They've confirmed it will be new game content to sort of give more closure and sort of complete the story of Mass Effect 3.
I mean, I think that sounds pretty great.
Yeah, I benefit of the doubt here. I think they've responded to what fans want, and as I said before, as long as they don't compromise their artistic vision, I'm down. I'm eager to see where they go.
And, you know, it's interesting that at first there was some confusion, and it's like, oh, it's only going to be cinematics. It's like, no.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think it seemed that way even from the initial announcement, but I appreciate that once they started talking about it, they were willing to come out, and community managers were able to say, like, no, it's going to be more than just cinematics. There's going to be gameplay. It's going to be all good.
Yeah, I mean, so that's pretty cool. And, I mean, I think really, I can't think of a better way that they could have responded, given the outcry from the fan base. I mean, like, I think they handled themselves pretty well. I mean, you know, as long as that remains to be seen after we actually play it, and if they totally are just trying to fan service us, then I don't know. But I mean, I think they've handled it appropriately, and you know, they've even put out multiplayer content as well, which I haven't had a chance to check out. But I mean, BioWare's really trying to support their fans and do what they can. So I mean, I think that they. That all the haters out there need to stop shitting over them all the time, you know?
Yeah. I'm cautiously optimistic.
Me as well. And I think the only thing I can say is that I hope there's more sex scenes. Because I waited all damn game to have sex with Kaden, and it was worth it, but I wanted more.
Oh my god. I have some news for you.
You do? You mean you have some...
News. Oh my god, news.
So, development on VanillaWare's newest 2D sprite masterpiece, Dragon's Crown, is back on track now. It looks like we're now going to have a 2013 targeted release date. And so far, the target platform is still the Vita, as well as presumably a PS3 release. Of course, those of you out there might remember VanillaWare. You know them from games such as Odin Sphere, Muramasa, all of these really beautiful 2D sprite work games. A lot of people were really excited about Dragon's Crown when the Vita was first announced because it was meant to be a launch window game, and it was going to be a budget title. It was going to launch at $29.99. Unfortunately, Atlas, who is picking this game up and is going to help Vanillaware finish it, they've gone on the record saying, you know, it's actually not going to be a budget title anymore, though, because we're throwing a lot of development power into this to make sure it's a good game. But I'm pretty excited. I definitely have been looking forward to this game for a long time. I'm a big fan of the studios. So, you know, hopefully this pans out.
Yeah, I mean, I think Atlas is a pretty good fit for a title like that. And, I mean, you know, it's interesting that they considered, you said $29.99?
Yeah.
Would have been budget. I mean, that's... I mean, because how much... I don't own a Vita. How much does a Vita full-price game go for?
Well, Uncharted set me back $49.99.
Are you serious? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, although, admittedly, every other game has been $39.99.
Because, see, $39.99 is, like, what I would expect to pay for a top-tier 3DS game. I mean, even probably, honestly, some DS games. I mean, like, I haven't gone to a Target or anything lately and looked at Pokemon White or Pokemon Black, but, I mean, you're still probably paying $34.99 for something like that, right?
I'm pretty sure that's what it launched at, and I don't know that it ever got a price drop. It's a Nintendo game,
so I mean, that's just that's just a DS game, not even a 3DS game. So I mean,
yeah, Kid Icarus cost me $39.99,
which is what I'm used to paying for a 3DS game. But I mean, so $29.99 versus $39.99, even $29 versus $49. I mean, who cares? If Atlas is backing it, it's probably gonna turn out pretty well, you know?
Yeah, I'm really excited. I agree. Atlas typically does, you know, they back some really great products. They brought the first Disgaea here. All kinds of, you know, the Persona games.
Well, yeah, I mean, those are huge. I mean, maybe not huge and like, hey, bro, let's play Call of Duty, but I mean, like, in the, like...
If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably the kind of person to whom it's huge.
Yeah. I mean, like, if I ask any of my nerd friends about Persona, it's like, yeah, so...
Yeah, that fucking Catherine was Atlas.
I mean, yes, I mean, it's very... And that's why I say it's in good hands, because, you know, it's... Atlas isn't like a, oh, lol, one of those companies that you're, like, just like, oh, really? Them?
Yeah.
You know, kind of like Anne from Arrested Development, her.
So, yeah. You know, that's how I felt when Ubisoft announced that they were going to bring Child of Eden out with, you know, Q Games. Like, Ubisoft? It was very much, you know, her?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's in good hands, and in 2013, it will be in your hands.
Lol.
You know, I don't know if I'm just looking for excuses, because anyone who knows me, and I mean... Even if you don't know me, you probably already know that I pretty much fucking hate Sony, but I kind of want a Vita, and I mean, I'm kind of, like, using, like, oh, hey, there's, like, some actually legit titles for once for a Sony platform, so... And maybe I'm just looking for an excuse to get a Vita, but...
I'm super happy with mine. It, really impressive tech. Software's starting to trickle in. You know, Disgaea 3 hit this week, so that's cool. I'm really enjoying that. Second news story I wanted to bring to you guys, and this is probably going to blow up all over the gaming blogosphere, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. It's not really what I'm here for. But EA has declared that they're going to give every game that they develop a quote-unquote online universe of its own. And that's interesting to me because they sort of experimented with that. Let me take a step back. They sort of experimented with this idea in Mass Effect 3. You have the main game, you have the iOS game that can also affect your sort of standing in the main game. You have your multiplayer that will also affect your standing in the main game. And from the sound of it, this discussion that EA had with Eurogamer... It looks like they're going to be bringing these kinds of game concepts to basically every big game that they bring out. I was a really big fan of that with Mass Effect 3, because as much as I hated that iOS game, I did love that my time away from my computer was still spent ultimately helping my Mass Effect game progress.
True, and I mean, I think... it makes a lot of sense to tap in. If they, like, if they know that there's a huge, you know, user base out there who's gonna buy shit, even if it's, like, $1.99, I mean, even if they have to, like, suffer, like, the low price point for the additional thing, or even if it's free, if that means more copies sold of the core game, I mean, it's smart, and, I mean, it is kind of cool, because, I mean, it, if I know that what I'm doing on the subway or, you know, on the toilet, I don't know, can contribute to my actual gameplay when I get back to my console or PC, you know, I mean, I think that's kind of a, you know, incentive to want to support their games, as long as they're good titles, but...
Yeah. And I'm really surprised that I only saw one news outlet reporting on this today, and to their credit, I have to say, it was Kotaku.
I am surprised. Color me shocked.
Yep, but, you know, for all the shade I throw, certainly Circle gets square here. Kotaku reported on something that I think is fascinating and has large-reaching implications, and they were the only one who ran the story. Hopefully that's just because it hasn't, you know, it hasn't really hit yet. And hopefully, you know, we'll see IGN and Joystick and, you know, Edge and, you know, hopefully we'll see everyone running this story.
Hopefully, or maybe it'll just get buried in the archive of shitty Kotaku posts and no one will speak of it, but we did, so.
Well, you know, it is super important that we all see another Portal cake.
True, or sexy gamer babe of the week. I don't even know if that's something they do, but it probably is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty... For, like, you know, it's not just going to be like, oh, like, for upcoming title. It's like, they're saying, like, oh, pretty much everything they're saying, right?
Yeah, they actually said all of their multi-platform titles. So, I don't know, I would love the idea of exploring, like, a Dead Space sort of gameplay experience where I'm playing a Dead Space game on my iPad that's exploring, like, sub-corridors or a sub-story of some kind to my main game that, once I link it to my EA account or Origin account or whatever, has some sort of bearing on my main game. I love that idea. I'm really into this.
Right.
This is what I thought the synergistic relationship between the Nintendo platforms were going to be, you know, the Wii and the DS.
Yeah, it was, which, those interactions were cute, but not quite there.
Yeah, yet. And it's really interesting to me that EA is the one that's pushing this, but
right, because
truly,
I mean,
more power to them.
You mean, you know, hate EA all you want. I mean, they were voted worst. Who was that? Was that, I can't remember who gave them the worst,
Yeah, they were voted the worst company in the U.S., like, I'm sorry. Have you ever fucking heard of Bank of America? Pardon my French. I try not to curse terribly much during these, you know, discussions. But
well, that's a fucking lie.
But, truly, EA is not the worst company in America.
Right.
They might not have the best customer relations in America. Certainly, they made a lot of people in the internet very angry and whiny over Twitter. But I have not seen any sort of truly malicious behavior that has oppressed anyone.
I mean, let's be real. I don't think they've done anything... I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, but have they really done anything much worse than Activision has? Hello, let's think about how the Guitar Hero franchise got totally melted until there was nothing left.
So, you know, if you have strong feelings about what we're saying right now, this would be a great time for you to tweet at us and tell us how full of hot air we are. If you disagree, you think EA, you personally think that they have done you dirty over the years.
If you think they're full of dark-sided stuff,
then now's the time to tell us. And we will totally read your tweet on the air, or at least respond to it in some form, so long as it's sensical. Sensible. So long as it makes sense. I don't know, whatever the proper way to say that is.
And depending on whether it is or not, we may read you, like, drag queen style.
Yeah, you may very well get read. if you're not respectful.
We might have to open the library. But before this turns into a Drag Race movie, let's get on with our show.
News. Oh my god, news.
So, for our discussion today, as I mentioned previously, we're going to be talking about Kickstarter.
Kickstarter!
Right? Like, I just want there to be a television commercial for Kickstarter that is like the old 80s Crossfire commercial.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like, you know, like, kids. Like, you know those 80s commercials where, like, it's like, that's not really what the toys are like. They make it look cool. It's like, get new Kickstarter from Mattel Toys.
Kickstarter!
So they wouldn't really be Mattel, but, you know. So, anyways, before we start writing our own jingle for Kickstarter...
This discussion was largely brought on by a PA report on the risks of Kickstarter.
Correct.
PA report, if you're not reading this yet, I highly recommend it. I have beef right now with games journalism as it currently exists. We're going to devote an episode to that in the future. But right now, long story short, Penny Arcade has gone and sort of taken the initiative to try and be a legitimate journalistic influence within the realm of games journalism.
I mean, imagine that, like, coming from a webcomic.
Well, you know, between this and PAX, they're one of the few sort of beacons,
right,
of non-anti-consumerism in this industry. And don't get me wrong, EA, to harken back to my point earlier, EA, they have certainly engaged in some anti-consumerist practice, just not to the extent that every other industry has seen in this country in the last 5 years.
Right.
But, certainly they do talk down to us and treat a lot of us like crap over Twitter, acting belligerent and a bit dumb. I mean, truly, the way they handled the Mass Effect thing, they could have handled it better. I'm happy, as I've said, with how they're handling it now, but for the first couple of weeks after release, I think they could have handled it better. But this is all sort of an aside. I want to discuss this Penny Arcade Report article. So, I'm going to give you guys a second in case you want to load that window up, you want to listen along with us.
And remember, we always have links to what we are talking about on GameBuie.org.
Yeah, just load up GameBuie.org, GameBuie.org, and you can pull up the link to the report that we're talking about, as well as news articles about any of the other things we've discussed in this episode so far.
So we're going to let you do that.
We're going to let you do that. We're going to give you, I don't know, 15 seconds or so if you want to follow along. We'll wait for you. Okay, do you got that? Report opened up, because it's time to start talking about it.
Yeah. If you don't have it open, you can go back to it later. You took too long.
So, this article, you know, it's called The Ugly Side of Kickstarter. The risks in backing game dev campaigns are greater than you think.
Talk about the ugly side of Kickstarter. What about the ugly side of that guy? Am I right?
I'm not going to talk. I don't know who that is. I don't want to be personally rude to him. But I do want to say real quick, that's a really sensationalistic headline.
Yeah.
I don't know about all that. But basically, you know, this article, it posits, and I'm going to sort of summarize here for the sake of discussion. It sort of posits that, you know, all of these people are putting money into Kickstarter. There's no promise on anyone's return here. We're not even legally owed a game for any of the Kickstarters that we potentially back. That makes it an incredibly unwise, in the eyes of the writer, a potentially unwise investment of your money and time to sort of give your money to people to make games and then to wait for the game to come out. And, you know, 18 months later, hopefully have a great game.
I mean, the equivalent is thinking, like, you know, going to your local deli or something, or, like, you know, a local sandwich shop, and then giving them money and they'd be like, we may make you a sandwich if enough people pay us.
Yeah, yeah, almost like a pre-ordering meat at your local deli. But if not enough people pre-order this meat, they might not get it. And then, if enough people do pre-order, well, we still may not deliver the meat, but we ordered it. And I mean, that's a clumsy analogy, but no offense.
Yeah, because I don't think people really pre-ordered meat at their local deli.
No. I wouldn't mind shopping at a deli like that, because it would be hilarious. Could you imagine a dinner party? Oh, I've had the meat pre-ordered since May.
I mean, I guess that's pretty legit, right. Yeah.
But, you know, outside of an amusing anecdote, I don't think it would be particularly functional. So, one really interesting thing about this article that you might be looking at, and are probably reading over as we spoil it for you, is that I haven't really considered that taxes are owed on monies donated.
True.
So, already, I have personally, and we'll get to this a little bit more later in this episode, but I personally have funded 4 Kickstarters so far.
Kickstarter!
Right? So, I hadn't really considered, though, do all of these 4 projects have sort of business-savvy individuals whom are going to be able to take care of the taxes? Or in 12 months, you know, next tax season, are the Shadowrun Returns guys going to be asking for more donations to cover the taxes on the first set of donations?
If there are any accountants out there looking for work, and you like video games, you might want to jump on to this potential need.
Yeah, get your resume ready and start hitting up the big ones. So, you know, that's interesting, and you know, the writer of this article and sort of the people that he talks to, in my opinion, they overestimate game budgets a little bit. They talk to one indie studio who says that he's never made a game for under $2 million. I do have to say, I know people who work for indie studios and do some iOS development, and with $2 million, they would turn out incredible product. You know, I've seen small groups of people ship games, you know, for, you know, $500,000, which is still a lot, certainly, but within the scope of these Kickstarters, it is, I feel, based on what I've seen people do, I think it's attainable.
Definitely.
Maybe not a Halo-quality first-person shooter.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think that's what most people are expecting when they're funding a Kickstarter game.
But no, I'm on Kickstarter because I want some goddamn wizardry clones and, you know, tactics games. And I think I'm going to get that for these Kickstarter, you know, amounts of money in their budget. I think that's attainable.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of exciting. I mean, like,
and another point they talk about in this article, you know, is that it might make sense to stick with Kickstarters being run by dev teams and personalities whom you sort of have a trust relationship built with through their shipped products.
I think that's valid to a certain extent.
You know, when I first read it, I thought, well, that sucks for the little guys. But then I thought about it, and certainly the projects that I personally have backed, you know, Shadowrun's Returns, the Double Fine Adventure, Wasteland 2. You know, these projects do come from sort of people whom I have realized, thinking about it, like, oh yeah, the reason why I donated so easily to these teams is because I do trust them.
You know what it makes me think of? It reminds me of when Radiohead was without a label and they did the In Rainbows thing.
Now that is a great analogy.
Because
yeah.
Think about it. I mean, like, you may not be a Radiohead fan, and if you're not a Radiohead fan, I'm kind of questioning your taste in music right now. But aside from that, if it had been some band you never heard of, would you be as willing to give them a few dollars for their record, as opposed to, oh, hey, Radiohead just announced a record. Give them some money of your choosing, and you can download it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a perfect analogy. Cause
no, I think it's a quite fitting
because analogy. You were able to donate, you know, if I wanted to donate a penny, I could, but I mean, I guess...
But sticking with your analogy, yeah. I wouldn't have donated... I'm just going to take three words from posters that are in this room right now. I wouldn't have donated to a live man legend if they had been the ones that did In Rainbows. But Radiohead? Yeah, of course. You know, Sal Williams did one for the Rise and Inevitable Liberation of Niggy Tardust.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, of course I supported that. So, you know, I think that statement and thought within this report has a lot of merit.
That's true. I mean, you could look at it as like, oh, it's not giving the little guys any chance, but I mean, that's not necessarily true. And I mean, I think it's a valid statement. And I'm, you know, to kind of follow up on our news last week about Sega, if it turned out that like, oh, Platinum doesn't have a home with Sega anymore, but hey, we'll do a Bayonetta Adventures Episode 1 if we can Kickstarter enough, you can bet your fucking ass that I would donate to that, you know?
Ignoring the potential problems with that as far as IP ownership
well,
and
yeah,
stuff.
Well, yeah, that's
but,
true.
But ignoring that just for the sake of your argument, I agree. Hell, I would donate... I've put 15 to each of the Kickstarters I've backed so far. For Bayonetta episodic continuation, I'd give more than $100, certainly, without question. Because I trust those guys. And maybe, for all the criticism within the gaming community that Kickstarter has sort of taken, all of the criticism, all the fire it's come under, maybe ultimately the answer is, Kickstarter can work if people utilize their own critical thinking skills.
Right, I mean, I can see... For some of the, like, I want to say, like, weirder types of games, you know, like, I could see, like, Suda 51.
Oh, girl, that's another one. Straight into my veins, I'll buy it at a high price.
Right? I mean,
but if some random yeah. no-name came out and was like, oh, hey, I'm gonna make, you know, Barra gay dating simulator, but I'm going to need $100,000. Well, honestly, if this is some dude you've never heard of, he doesn't have a compelling pitch put together, which is another thing they talk about in this article, you know, sort of the package that you're selling to your supporters. Maybe as much as you'd like to play that game, you don't want to support it, because you don't know who this guy is, and it's unlikely he can deliver that product for that little amount of money. I would probably evaluate, and, you know, if he had a minimum $10 donation that scored me a copy of the game, I'd probably be willing to lose $10. To me, that would be an acceptable risk. But what people really need to look at sort of the focus of this article, which, again, we're just sort of summarizing, you're really doing yourself a favor to read it in its entirety if you haven't, is that evaluate what you're willing to lose and what you're willing to pay, and don't go over that. Don't spend $10 on this thing if you're not going to be able to walk away from that $10 and get nothing for it. It sounds crappy, but you pretty much have to assume you are giving $10 away in the hopes that your positive karma will bring you this Barra dating simulator down the line.
I mean, I think it's less of throwing my money away than, you know, betting on a horse at the races would be. And I mean, I'm not judging anyone who would go to the races.
No, that's actually great. That's a great point. And a much less cynical point is that you're sort of betting. And if you think betting and gambling is super ridiculous and dumb, you probably have no business in this style of game development.
I mean, I think it's potentially for, like I said, like, the weird, odd type of games that aren't, you know, like, again, you know, not like the Call of Duties, but like the No More Heroes types of games, the Bayonettas, the Catherines. Like, for these types of games, which, I mean, clearly there's a lot of love for them, even if it's not, like, huge sellers, you know? I mean, I think that that could be a really good fit for, like, these sorts of things. And, you know, I think it's actually kind of exciting. But I think one thing that, one general sentiment that I've seen kind of just floating around the internet is like, oh, is this going to affect the future of the industry? Ooh. I'm like waving my fingers in like a ominous, magical way right now, which you can't see, but I'm doing that.
Yeah, and, you know, that's, I have to say this, I'm biased. If you listen to this show, you probably know how biased I am. But I would like to see this influence the industry. I hope EA and Activision, I hope they see how badly we all want Double Fine Adventure and realize that they're not providing us with product that we'd willfully fork over our money for. I hope that Microsoft sees how many people want Shadowrun to return as an RPG. I hope they see that and are kicking themselves in the darn head over the fact that they made a Shadowrun first-person shooter.
Lol. And, I mean, my opinion is, I mean, I'm no psychic. I'm a slackick, but I ain't no psychic. Do I think it's going to revolutionize the industry? Not entirely. Did Radiohead's In Rainbows thing totally revolutionize the music industry? Not in a huge dramatic way, but I mean, there's definitely been changes. I mean, like, think about the Spotify thing, music being delivered in that way. Think about things like Madonna foregoing a record label to partner with Live Nation. I definitely think that it has interesting implications for the industry. I don't think it's going to totally turn the industry on its head. Oh, look, the big three hardware developers are totally gone, and, I mean...
No, I don't think it's going to change or revolutionize the industry to that degree. But I would love to see this spark interest at the big publishers for more niche products. Things that maybe aren't, you know, AAA sellers, but that, you know, digital copies, you know, that you can sell still turn, you know, at least a little profit, and cater to this market, and don't just let the entire industry stagnate in Call of Duty 9, or whatever the hell number they're on now.
Right, and I mean, I think it's actually interesting, because I know a lot of friends who are, I mean, we kind of touched on this last time, that, like, you know, what's the gaming industry going to look like over the next couple of years? It kind of was looking dire with Sega, but, you know, I'm actually a little more optimistic now. And
yeah, now that the dust has cleared on that Sega thing, things don't look quite as bleak as they did the day that news broke.
Right. And I mean, I think the thing is that if we have, like, Kickstarter sorts of things going on, then, you know, maybe all hope is not lost. I mean,
I tell you, I don't want to see corporations abuse Kickstarter, but I wouldn't mind if Sega did a Kickstarter for the localization of, for example, Valkyria Chronicles 3. I would not be opposed to Sega starting a Kickstarter for that localization project.
I think it would be a better PR move than, hey, we're Nintendo and we're not going to bring over all these games that you really want.
Yeah, I mean...
And then people crying out for it, and then you do. And
yeah, I mean, and just give us the option. Let us vote with our dollars as to whether you need to localize this game.
Vote with your dollars? You're sounding like you're talking about the Vita.
No, I just mean, let us prove to you that the game that you think you can't make money on, let us prove to you that you can. And, you know, I appreciate that a lot of people don't want to see Kickstarter go in that direction. And I respect that some people think this is a slippery slope. I do. But to me, I would rather have this avenue to put my money where my mouth is and show companies that I want this product than just not have the chance to get this product. And unfortunately, the way the industry works right now, the entire industry is on a slippery slope not to deliver games that underperform. So, for every person out there that says, oh, I shouldn't have to pre-buy this game, they should bring it to America and I can vote with my wallet then. Well, yes, I agree, in an ideal world that would happen. But we're living in a world where like 60 development studios have closed this generation.
And I mean, let's be honest, unless you're a total indie game snob, and you're like, oh, I will only play things that are not from major studios. Let's be honest, if you're someone who is, like, complaining about that, you're probably someone who, like, would pre-order Mass Effect or something. Let's be real. So if you're willing to pay money, and sure, yes, Mass Effect 3 is going to come out, like, you know, I'm speaking in the past tense, because obviously the game's already out, but if you're probably that type of person who you would pre-order a Wii U or something. I mean, sure, yes, that is going to be delivered unless there's a zombie apocalypse. But, I mean, if you're going to give money in advance to a corporation that's, like, super big...
Yeah,
what's the harm? I mean, and if you're that concerned about $10, then...
Yeah, you probably don't have any business, you know, pre-ordering games. I mean,
if coming up with $10 for a game is too tough for you, then I don't know how you have internet access right now to listen to this podcast. That might have been a little bitchy, but I'm just saying.
And I don't mean to be negative about it. I appreciate that people have concerns about this trend for a variety of reasons.
My thing is if you don't want to support the game, no one's forcing you to give your money.
Well, and that's exactly where I come in, and that's, you know, it's exactly that. I want this tool to exist, and I would find it desirable for this tool to exist to let developers know they can serve the niche audiences. This can be profitable. You do not have to die in obscurity because you think you can't bring titles to the U.S. or what have you.
And I think that's a really positive and hopeful thing for gamers like us who actually value these sorts of titles and value these developers who may have, for one reason or another, been let go.
But, you know, if you do disagree with us and you're willing to, you know, sort of voice that in a respectful manner and have, you know, a discussion with us on this, send us an email. Tell us why you dislike Kickstarter. Tell us why you fear for its implications on the future of this industry.
True, but, you know, just think about this. Wouldn't it be great if Team Bondi, for example, because, you know, we all know what happened to them.
Yeah, 4.5 million units sold wasn't enough. They're gone.
So, I mean, imagine if Team Bondi, the former members of that, put something together on a Kickstarter and were like, hey, look, people do want to support us. And then who would be kicking themselves? And, you know, I mean...
I will say, and I don't mean to sort of backpedal, but if you want to talk about a Kickstarter project that would probably come in out of schedule and over budget, it would probably be by Team Bondi. No tea, no shade. I'm not trying to be rude or be mean to anyone, but let's be real. I can't believe that game wasn't profitable. I believe that game must have made a profit, but probably not as big as it should have, given how long it took them to work on it.
I guess in some ways it really makes you appreciate the Activision and Blizzard relationship, because if there's one company that cannot deliver a product when it's expected, it's Blizzard.
Yeah,
it's love to them, but...
It's cool, though. We may actually get Diablo 3 soon. You know, we're less than a month out, and it still hasn't been delayed any further.
Well, they announced the date, so...
Yeah, less than a month away, and it still hasn't been pushed back, so...
But yeah, we digress.
One last thing, and I just wanted to just touch this on sort of a more personal note. Have you funded any Kickstarters?
I haven't yet. I mean, it's not out of, like, rebellion or, like... I really haven't had a chance to really explore what's on there yet.
Okay.
But, I mean, I could definitely see myself investing in a project if it really tickled my fancy.
Excellent. Yeah, that's how I was. And then I ended up toward the end of the Double Fine Adventure Kickstarter tossing in some money, because by then, you know, Wasteland 2 was going, and some ex-BioWare guys have this Banner Saga thing happening. It's a really pretty 2D tactics game. I'm super into sprite-based tactics games, so I was like, yes, please.
Yeah, that was kind of actually the first one that where my ears perked up. I'm like, oh, ex-BioWare?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, all right, I guess at this point we've said all there is to say about that.
So I think it's time to have some laughs.
It's time for that that segment, everyone's favorite.
And you'll notice we've slightly changed the name, and would you like to explain why?
You know, and this sort of was spurred on by what I said earlier. I have problems with games journalism. In a big picture sense, it is not just Kotaku that's dropping the ball. And as I said earlier, Kotaku even nailed some stories that no one else is hitting. So I felt it was inappropriate to single them out as the Kotaku lol of the week, or the lol-taku lol of the week. So we're going to, in the future, be featuring stories potentially from every gaming news source.
Yeah, because, I mean, let's be real. Joystick isn't always full of the win.
Yeah, they had that Nier review where they literally scored the game 0 out of 5 because they couldn't figure out how to fish. And just to give you a hint, you press the A button.
Womp womp.
So... this week's Loltaku of the Week does admittedly come from Kotaku.
Yes, that...
And I just want to say, in particular, it is for one paragraph of this article that we're about to cite, and that you can find a link to on our blog if you want to see it. Maybe you agree with them. Hell, I don't know. This is about Marvel versus Tekken, Street Fighter versus Tekken, I'm sorry. It's about the Infinite Combo. And the article is called In Defense of the Infinite Combo, which only ruins Street Fighter matches sometimes. Okay, first off, that's a really smarmy title for your post. I mean,
yeah.
That's a stylistic thing. I guess whatever. Totila's gonna do what Totila's gonna do. But that's unnecessarily sarcastic, I feel. And, I guess my problem with this article, this one paragraph problem, is that, you know, they're talking to Seth Killian, who has been sort of at the forefront of the American side of this whole fighting game renaissance for Capcom. He's been a big name for all of, like, the Street Fighter fight clubs and sort of, the revival of Marvel versus Capcom. You know, he's an important guy over at Capcom Unity. He basically is talking about how, you know, they're looking at sort of the unfair infinite combos that currently exist in Street Fighter versus Tekken. And, you know, now that sort of the best fighting game competitors in the world are playing this game, they're finding infinite combos that were never intended to exist. And Seth Killian is like, you know, but to us this is actually a good thing, because that means that our fighting system is so complex and so elastic and allows for so much freedom to the high-end game that these sort of emergent play styles are coming through where things that we didn't intend to be possible are possible. And, you know, that's actually kind of a really cool thing. But for the purpose of game balance, we're going to have to patch those out. And that's something which I personally strongly agree with. One of my favorite memories as a kid, and I hate that I'm sharing this over this podcast, is that I was playing Mortal Kombat 3 as a kid. I was using whichever Robot Ninja could throw out the nets and bombs combination. And I found an infinite combo by keeping someone in the air through the entire match, where you could win a match with an infinite combo, or at least a 100% damage combo, within, like, I don't know, 13 seconds? So, I would do this on occasion to other players just to mess with them, because, you know, I was like this 11, 12-year-old kid doing these super cool combos. And once someone threatened me and was like, hey, that's really not cool, this is not a fun way to play this game, and you should not do that to people. And that sort of opened my eyes, like, that's a shitty thing to do to people that are paying to play a game with you. So I agree with Seth Killian. Like, it's really cool that these game systems can bend this way without snapping, and that, you know, you can do these cool things, but for the sake of everyone having fun, maybe they shouldn't be in. And the problem with Kotaku comes in, this is probably what, I don't know, maybe 10 paragraphs down. Totillo takes sort of the opposite tact, and instead of trying to understand Seth Killian's point and sort of empathize with why it's great to develop these things but sucks to leave them in, he takes the opportunity to complain about the price of the game. I quote, "Got that? It's about freedom. It's about flexibility. Still, you might think, infinite seem awfully unfair. If a player can't defend themselves, that ruins the flow of the game. It makes the action one-sided. Buying a game for $60 maybe should ensure that you don't get games that contain that kind of flaw." And for that, Stephen Totillo, for not understanding that this is a good part of game design, that this reflects well on high-end gameplay in a fighting game, for not even understanding that you parroted most of Seth Killian's words to him before taking your own small-minded jab at them, for that you're awarded our Lolotaku of the Week. Do you have anything to say about that, Mr. Slagkick?
I just have to say that, and I mean, I don't know Stephen Totillo personally. He could be a really cool guy, but it seems like he's just trying to be edgy.
Oh yeah, right? Like,
and it's like,
no, I mean no personal offense. I know it sounds like I just meant personal offense, but, you know, I before he wrote for Kotaku, I was actually a big fan of Stephen Totillo's writing. I thought he was a great thing for games journalism. I thought he was a sign that games journalism was getting better all the time, man.
And, I mean, certainly, we're not saying that having an opinion or having a bias is wrong. I mean, we're pretty biased in this episode alone, but, I mean,
but if someone is defending their game to you and explaining why a mechanic you don't like exists, and why they think that mechanic is cool, but they do ultimately agree with you that it needs to be patched out, maybe you can come up with a better response than complaining about the price. Or some kind of perceived lack of bug testing that you seem to think occurred, when ultimately this is the kind of thing that would only emerge in high-end play.
Well, I mean, what do you expect from the news site that takes an article about game delay to complain about how ugly it is?
Oh man, you know, that's another thing. They ran a story on Dice Senryaku Perfect, which I'm a fan of the Dice Senryaku games. We've only gotten a handful of them here in the US, but they're super hardcore military tactical strategy simulators. And they are not made on a big budget. So Dice Senryaku Perfect is supposed to be coming out to Japan. It was supposed to come out this year. Kind of looks like it might be getting pushed into 2013. And rather than talk about why that sucks for people that are into this kind of game, Kotaku decided instead that this was a good opportunity just to talk about how bad the graphics are.
Not only did they say that the graphics were bad, they said it looks like dung.
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 So,
Instead of having potentially legitimate things to say about the graphics, they said it looks like poop.
Yeah, I guess if you want to call out you know, poor texture work, low polygon models that look like they belong to the PC game that this was is being ported from that came out, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago.
And to be fair, it looks very antiquated, but I mean...
Oh, it does, because it's a 6 or 7 year old PC game in a niche genre where they're not going to make a big return on the game in the first place. So, I don't know, is it better to just not release the game than have it have graphics that look like dung? Is that what you're saying? Would you rather just have Call of Duty 9?
Or would it be Call of Duty 9?
On one hand, I'm really ashamed that you took it there, and on the other, I'm super proud.
And you know, not only did they say that it looks like dung, but the headline was, Japan's crappiest-looking game is addicted to delays. I bet Brian Ashcraft thought he was being really clever by making the crappy and the dung thing, but I'm like, come on.
Yeah, I have to say, I used to think Ashcraft was super good-looking. So, I mean, nothing personal, Ashcraft. We don't dislike you, but that's a really inappropriate way to talk about this game and talk about the real issue affecting this game's development.
Except I'd like to just point out that if you look at the article, and I mean, which you can do so on our website, GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
You may notice that there are related stories. One related story is shittiest looking game of 2011 delayed. Do you know what game that's referring to?
What game is that?
You need to say it because my Japanese is horrible.
Is it Daisen Ryaku Perfect?
It is, and it's using the same exact header graphic. And,
so basically, Kotaku likes to bag on Daisen Ryaku, despite it being a super great series for hardcore strategy enthusiasts.
Yeah, so basically, not only, and we usually will not try to bag on Waltaku twice in 1 week, but, I mean, not only did they say the game looks like dung, but they, Brian Ashcraft basically just, because the game was delayed, he basically posted the same article he did almost a year ago. Because the original one was the shittiest looking game of 2011 is delayed. So, I mean, it's one thing, like I said, it's one thing to have a legitimate complaint about it or talk about the delays, but to just rehash what you said?
And not only to just rehash, but again, to rehash something that isn't funny and ignores the very real sort of dire straits that this industry is in. We should be happy that Daisen Ryaku Perfect exists, not bagging on it for looking quote-unquote crappy.
Yeah, and I mean, not only that, there was also a third original article from May of last year.
Are you serious?
Asking, are these the crappiest console graphics of 2011? And to be fair, there was one little statement in this original one that says, what Daisen Ryaku sacrifices on visual candy, it does offer its fans a large array of weapons, customization, and according to the developer, advanced AI. And then later it just says, graphics aren't everything, but at 8,000 yen, they should be something.
And I just can't abide that. But, you know, if you think we're being too hard on Kotaku, this is the time to tell us. Tweet us. Again, I mean, if you throw shade at us and you're very rude to us, we're gonna be rude right back. So let's not do that.
Let's have a civil discussion as much as pirates
and anonymous trolls on the internet can.
Yeah.
And let's really talk about this. Are we being too hard on Kotaku? Does the Games Enthusiast Press deserve a free pass since it's being read mostly by 13-year-old boys? Ignoring the fact that, statistically speaking, it seems that the majority of the gaming audience are dudes in their late 20s, early 30s. Throwing that all out the window, the preconceived notion is that most gamers are 13-year-old boys. Does that make it okay to pander to your audience?
And does it make it okay
with these fecal jokes and...
And does it make it okay to basically repost the same story a year later? Instead of, like you said, perhaps offering some insight as to why it was delayed. And maybe if you were at least saying, well, you know, with all these delays, we could hope for maybe some improved texture work, some lighting, instead of being like, it looks like dung. Who even says dung?
Right? I don't know, Beatles, maybe. Not the Beatles, I mean freaking Beatles dung with pincers Beatles. And...
Dung Beatles, B-E-E-T-L-E-S.
Exactly so.
Anyways, we got a bonus lol for you this week, but that was our...
Lol of the week!
Okay. And with that, you know, it's been fun, but it's time to go. As always, we want to throw our shout-outs to Fabulous Flames... you know, Slag Kicks WoW podcast. If you want more of Slag Kicks super gay humor, Fabulous Flames will hook you right up. Also, Orange Lounge Radio, the guys over there, they are basically our inspiration and our reason for podcasting.
They're basically our BFFs, too. So.
They are basically our BFFs. And I feel they have done... the community, great things as far as giving every gamer a voice, and I can't speak highly enough of them. We love you guys. Thank you for existing. Thank you for all your support. And this is not really a shout-out so much as a request. Help us stop existing in a box. Write us, email us, tweet us, and spread word to your friends if you like what we're throwing down here. We're trying to have civil, intelligent discussion about games... while staying fun and, you know, maybe poking a little fun and, you know, talking some trash about Loltaku, but obviously we read them every day. We patronize them with our clicks because, you know, truthfully, they're still better than IGN. You can't spell...
A pile of dung is better than IGN, let's be real.
Yes. Unless you have any shout-outs or solicitations for support.
Tweet us, write to us, Captain Spike can be... reached at cpt.spike@gamebuoy.org. And please make sure you're spelling buoy, B-U-O-Y. I hate to give a spelling lesson, but, I mean, if there's anyone trying to go to gamebuoy.org, we're not gameboy.org. So,
again, that is gamebuoy.org.
And I am at slagkick@gamebuoy.org. Also, like us on Facebook. We, would like to be able to have some legit interaction with you on the social media web 2.0 business deals.
Absolutely.
So, do that.
And with that, Godspeed you. I hope your gaming endeavors go well until we meet again.
Oh, also write a review for us on iTunes. We'll love you.
We're on iTunes?
We're on iTunes.
That's awesome. I need to subscribe right now.
And I am ashamed that you haven't yet.
And so should you all out there.
Yes, you should.
All right, good night, Radioland. We love you. Stay gaming, stay cool, stay thinking for yourself.
Bye!